Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo and I'm broadcasting to you from Anchorage, Alaska. And my guest today that we're going to be talking with, Dr. Dayton Alverson. He has been a University of Washington affiliated professor, a retired director of the Northwest and Alaska Fisheries Center. He lives in the Seattle, Washington area at this time, and he has been involved with a career that I think is so fascinating, especially with the world that we have of changes that we're experiencing today relative to oceans, fish, and environmental issues. And this man has worked for state and federal and international agencies and has published over 150 scientific, technical papers and several books. Dr. Alverson, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Your book is titled Race to the Sea, The Autobiography of a Marine Biologist. And I absolutely love the cover of your book because you have five pictures of various fishing vessels, from the little ones all the way up to the supersized one. Your material in your book is so fascinating. You have given not only a wonderful story about your life and growing into this area of industry, which is a big conversation for a lot of people today, the world of the sea, but you also incorporated so much terrific technical information. How long did it take you to put together your story? I know this is your autobiography.
I've been working on it about 5.5 years.
I can believe it. I'm just absolutely in awe of what you've been able to put in this book, and the way that it has been put together is fascinating reading because you weave in part of your own personal life experience and also the world of marine biology. Tell us a little bit about your family, where you came from, and I know you were born in 1924 on October the 7th, but what was your family like? I mean, what kind of environment did you grow up in?
Well, my father was a naval officer, and I grew up in an environment of travel. I went to 5 different grammar schools before I was in the 6th grade.
Amazing.
So it was a lot of travel, new people, new experiences continually. At the time I was in the 6th grade, I'd lived in the Philippines. I'd lived in the Hawaiian Islands. I'd lived out on Tatoosh Island at the end of the state of Juan de Fuca. So it was a life of meeting new people, new cultures, continually. And it sort of remained that way the rest of my life.
That's the truth. A pattern emerged when you were young, and it stayed with you for your entire life. Tatoosh Island, now your book is loaded with all kinds of photographs. And I love the one of you and your brother just on the island. It's just absolutely great. And this was taken in 1930. And when you were in Hilo, when you go back to Hilo today, I imagine it's almost like a cultural shock because of the memories that you have of the time that you were there. But you had such good fortune by being able to be in so many different environments and interact with so many different people. And what you expressed when you were growing up is that the opportunity to explore was really encouraged by your parents.
Yes, it was. Hilo was a great experience, and I've gone back a number of times, and I've had friends there that you note in the book, and we've met with each other, and up until very recently when they died, we met with them every time we went back to Hilo.
Now, you seem to always end up in an environment associated with the sea.
Yes.
Whether it was in San Diego, whether it was in the islands, there was always this link.
Everywhere.
No, everywhere that you went.
Was it adjacent to or right on the ocean?
Mm-hmm. It's just amazing how there was this synchronicity between your life, the way you were raised, and how you evolved into marine biology. Let's go forward a few years, because as a young man, you found yourself going into the service. You were in the Second World War, but you weren't just an ordinary soldier. You ended up going to China.
Yes.
Tell us how that evolved.
Experience that very few people have.
That's the truth. I mean, you're the first person I've known of. I've known of people that were in Italy and in different parts of Europe. But China?
You know that the records of the Navy group in China were so secret that I didn't get a number of my medals till 40 years after the war because the records were never released.
Tell about the organization and what happened during the Second World War and what made you go to China.
Well, I joined the Navy in San Diego when I was 17 with my parents' consent. And after going through the normal quick training, I was sent off, fortunately, to be with a very exclusive group of Navy code breakers. And I served with that group in San Diego, near San Diego, for over a year and a half before going off to China. And I didn't have any control over the thing. I actually, they asked for a group to volunteer for a mission, and we didn't know what the mission was. Actually, you know, I tell them, I don't know if I told them the book, but there was a shortage of strawberry pickers in the San Diego area, and they were asking for volunteers for the service, and we kind of thought that's what it was, and turned out that we were misguided.
Just a little bit. You weren't going to be picking strawberries. You were going to travel in China doing code breaking. Now, tell us a little bit about that training, because it was so secretive. You never really understood what was going on. You just did what you were told.
Well, so we knew what the mission was, and you're right. Each little group had a part of it. Part of it was a group that was copying all the Japanese code. Another part was breaking it apart, and the other part was sending it out to people who put it into effect and useful. Of course, you probably are well aware that Midway was a result of the code breaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were a lot of things that went on with code breaking,
yes,
that were quite significant, both with the Japanese as well as the Germans.
That's right.
So it's quite significant, and I don't think that many young people today in their history classes are even made aware of this.
I'm quite sure that's true.
Yes. Now, when you ended up going into Calcutta. You were on a train to Calcutta. I mean, really, this would make a great movie. Nobody would believe that someone had been to as many places as you had, and it's all because you were in the Navy.
That's right. Well, and of course, nobody ever expected the Navy to end up in China. It was called the Rice Paddy Navy.
Fascinating. Now, when you were in Calcutta, one of the things that you mentioned with such vividness in your book is that for the first time in your life, you saw abject poverty and people who were begging that had been purposefully deformed so that they could beg to make a living.
Absolutely everywhere.
And that, yeah, it was just phenomenal. Absolutely.
You know, you saw people sleeping on the streets and the children sleeping on the streets and everybody with their hand out looking for money, and you just couldn't take care of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Now, you ended up going over the Himalayas.
Right.
You ended up going into...
they call it crossing the hump.
Mm-hmm. Crossing the hump. And you had to be in charge of 22 men going to Kunming.
Yeah, in the transportation over to Kunming, that's correct. And
now,
I think I was 19 years old.
19 years old and being in charge of this. Now, one of the things that you talk about, and the reason that this is important for those of you who are listening, a person's life sometimes will take them into twists and turns, and you had more than enough in yours. But all of this, there were links continually that were going to end up being of use to you in later years. But when you got into, what was the area? When you got into China,
you were in 1944.
1944, and some information you have here. In 1943, the Allies had lost about 5% of their planes going over the hump, but there were fewer losses in 1944. But there were still major problems with them being shot down, mechanical problems. Passengers had to use oxygen for a good part of the trip. And it was just, you paint a picture of an evolution of circumstances that were requiring and demanding change, fast-moving change during the war. And you end up going into China, and much of China had been taken over by the Japanese.
Yeah, you know, China was the only region in the war at that period of time that where we were still losing.
Mm-hmm.
Story.
Yes, and
the Japanese
it was pretty
were still making advances.
Yes, they were. And you said the Japanese controlled all of the coastal cities, had choked off access to the country via the Burma Road, and that the only way the Allies could get in was by air transport over the Himalayas. And that's rugged airspace.
That's right. Well, you know, eventually the Burma Road was open, but at the time I went through, almost everybody was going in by air. And it was, you know, you spent half your time learning how to, you're supposed to survive if you got shot down.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that training is still going on with a lot of our boys and gals even today.
I'm sure it is.
Now, talk about the Seiko Tigers. This is so fascinating because you had a journey that took you down a stretch of water. Actually, it involved with so many people. And many times you didn't know who you could trust, and yet the people you didn't think you could trust were the ones that you could trust.
That's quite right. You know, we lived among people that for a long time we had to accustom ourselves that they might turn us in, or, you know, there was always that thought in your mind there was a price on our heads and that they could turn us in at any time.
Mm-hmm.
But
that
thing, it never happened once. All over, you know, we had about 1,200 people spread around China, and none of them were ever turned over. Although we had some captured, none were ever turned over by Chinese forces.
It's just your photography, too, about places in China where you stayed. There is so much that is disappearing of, actually has already disappeared, that in today's world, many people would not even be able to recognize. They wouldn't be able to recognize these village styles and the way the people lived and how hard it was for the people of China battling.
There's no comparison, although if I had to guess, I think that Western China is still in a fairly primitive state, but the places I went back to, I went back to China after the war, you probably remember in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you did.
I didn't even recognize the villages because they'd grown up into big cities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the points that you bring out about China that I thought is very, very important because we're dealing with this very issue today, and that is that most of the major forests in China had been cut down centuries ago.
That's true.
So much of it.
And you didn't think there were any, and I think you remember in the book, I was so surprised when we ran into something that looked like old growth large firs or old growth sequoia.
Yes, that's right. And you said they were bigger than any of the yellow pines or other evergreens that covered Idlewild Valley.
I'm sure they were a type of sequoia.
Mm-hmm. But that is something that I think many people don't realize today. We are so concerned about the deforestation of our planet that we're going through right now, that there were many cultures that denuded their environment, and that, in effect, ended up changing the very environment that they had once had that may have been tropical or warm or beautiful when they took all the trees away.
Had to probably change both the environment and change the habitat they lived to a point where they had to restructure their lives.
Absolutely. And that's something that's happening right now in our world. I mean, look at Easter Island and other places.
It's a continuing process.
It is very much a continuing process. Now, you went through all kinds of travel. You had a Cape 6 location. SACO soldiers were so important. They were very well trained. They understood so many things, and it was really because of them and a number of people that were brave enough to put their lives on the line that the Allies finally were able to start turning things against the Japanese.
Well, they were part of the total story, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So here you are. You've had this extraordinary, you know, evolution of travel and being involved in all of these different cultures, meeting all of these different people. And then the war comes to an end. Believe me, folks, when I'm going through this, you have no idea the stories that are in here. This is wonderful, wonderful reading. But when you finally, when the war was finally over and you were able to leave the service, that is when your life took you into the environment of marine biology. And I think you should share your story as to why that was something you decided to get into.
Well, you know, I got back to San Diego, and so many people tell you that they had their life structured from an early time. Well, I hadn't the slightest idea where I was going to be, although I'd had the tremendous background of being in the marine environment, as you know. And my brother happened to bring this book to me on various universities and pointed out that the University of Washington had a wonderful school that dealt with fisheries. So that turned my mind and changed, put me in that pattern.
Well, now, when you decided you were going to do this, and it was about 1947, you needed to select your major, and that's where your brother came in.
Right.
And then you said you became curious. You didn't even know what marine and freshwater biologists did.
No, you know, my wife and I thought we'd end up living in a hatchery and raising hatchery fish or something like that.
Oh, boy.
Naive about the whole arena.
Yes, and I have to chuckle because when I look through and I see, you know, you were, the two of you as a couple were always budgeting. But I have to share with my audience that at the time that you were ready to go to school, you found a place to live in, and it was $19 a month, and that included heat and electricity.
That was the small apartment we moved into. We gradually moved into a little larger that actually had a bedroom attached to it, and that was $27, but that was still, you know, you compare those prices today, $27 with heat and light and the whole bit, and it was on the GI Bill. We still managed to live with that.
That's right.
$114 a month, and we managed to pay those bills and go to school.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. That's part of, again, what you bring into this book is all of these little details that are woven like a very fine tapestry, and it shows what life was like, the cost of living, what you dealt with, and how it changed. Now, you had a friend or one of the people that you worked with called Buddy.
Oh, that I knew over in Hawaii.
Yes.
Yes.
And you interacted with him. When you started to get involved in marine biology, did you have any idea that you were going to be out on boats most of the time counting fish?
None whatsoever.
What was your first experience like when you did that? And
how did
they keep the records?
My first experience is while I was going to school, I decided one summer that I'd try to get some experience, and I managed to get a job down with the Oregon Fish Commission, and I was going up on one of the very good salmon rivers to tag salmon. And when I got up there, I was there 2 days, and they asked me if I'd go down to Astoria, Oregon, because the biologist they had assigned to their marine work down there was getting too seasick to go. So I went down there and 2 days after I was there, I went out on a 65-foot small trawler and had the experience of my life.
That was the beginning.
That
and what
was the
year
beginning.
Was that?
I saw people dragging fish, probably 50 to 50 different species, most of which the markets wouldn't take, but I learned a lot the fact that what I learned in school quickly needed to be relearned when you got out in the field.
Isn't that the truth? And I think that's still the case today with a lot of different jobs and positions. Now, this was when? This was in 1950, about that time?
Well, the first time I went out on the boat was 49.
Okay, that was 49. And then in 1950, you were at the Montlake Laboratory.
Yeah, I took a job with the Montlake Laboratory in Seattle, Washington. And that was a job going to sea on a boat that did surveys of what the latent resources of the oceans off our Pacific Northwest coast up through Alaska might be.
Now, in doing this research, how did you keep the records? Were computers available to tabulate a lot of this, or did all of this have to be done manually?
Well, you know, there were computers during World War I. I actually saw the big computer they used for code breaking, and it would practically fill my house, and now you got more power and a little desk computer than you had at that time. But when I started, computers weren't available. There were some pretty fancy calculators, but you didn't have computers available.
So all of this record-keeping had to be done manually?
All had to be done manually at the beginning. But by early 50s, computers started to come into the game.
Now, you were out on these boats. You would go out. Some of them, you talk about the fishing season in the Pacific Northwest, which is home to me as well. And in the Pacific Northwest, the fishermen didn't have a lot of time to get their fish. And you said that the fishing occurred frequently 75 to 200 miles offshore. Now, what were the boundaries at that time for fishing?
Well, you're talking about the national limits?
Yes.
The national control over the oceans was 3 miles at that point in time.
Now, what about international controls, or were there any at that time?
There were international controls. That's why you had these large distant watcher fleets that developed shortly after the war, and you had the explosion in fisheries all over the world, and vessels ending up fishing out of Europe, fishing down the Indian Ocean, and fishing from Japan over all off our coast, and from Europe all off the east coast of the United States, etc.
Now, one of the points that you bring out in your book is the fact that it was the United States was really behind times when it was not. It really wasn't aware. The United States government was really not aware of the explosiveness and the resourcefulness of these other countries for fishing. And one of the points that you said was that it was surprising how the Russians had developed phenomenally large trawlers. Often in today's world, we'll talk about the Japanese coming in with these humongous trawlers. But at this time in the 50s, they already had, after the war, started building because this was food to feed people, and the population was, after the war, a big baby boom had started.
That's right, and the Russians had a major 10-year program of building their fisheries because, you know, they don't have the areas to do animal husbandry such as we did, and so one of their major goals was to increase animal protein by explorations of the world's oceans.
Now, there's, again, so much in your book. I just was fascinated by it. I was not aware that the Romans, over 2,000 years ago, had been involved in aquaculture. I was aware of the Hawaiian peoples having aquaculture and the Polynesians, but I wasn't aware that the Romans had done it.
Well, the Romans and the Greeks and a number of the people through the Mediterranean cultures had begun aquaculture, before Christ.
So when we're looking at what we're dealing with today, and there's such a furor over aquaculture for so many different reasons, this is something that's nothing new. I mean, this has been going on in different cultures because they realized they had overfished their areas as well. And here we've got all of this wonderful information that you passed along here, and it just brings home to us as people that we need to recognize that this is a very important resource, and we have to pay attention. So here are all of these ships, from around the world, the Japanese. The Chinese were involved a little bit, but the Japanese, the Russians, all of them. So how did this evolve? I mean, when wasn't there an international group that formulated that was going to deal with this? When did people start waking up?
Well, there was a fisheries department under the United Nations, but they were largely guidance, and they were a part of the help that were sending out information all over the world how to develop fisheries. They were a part of those that were promoting the growth of fish as animal protein, as was the United States and many other countries of the world. We're putting money into ocean exploration so that we could see what was out there. And there was at one time some thought that the oceans held enough animal protein to take care of all the hungers throughout the whole world. So, you know, we overestimated what was in the oceans in terms of sustainable yield.
Also, not only that, but thinking we could take out billions and billions of tons of fish and we don't have to worry about it, that they're just going to pop right back in.
Yeah.
And many of these species, I know, coming up into Alaska I've been traveling to for almost 30 years now, and I really was educated by many fishermen in Alaska, and I just so appreciate their knowledge because they would tell me that halibut could live to be 75 years of age. I hadn't a clue. All I had in my head, like most people, this is just a nice white fish, a nice firm fillet that you get served at a restaurant. Little realizing,
has a very long longevity and can be very large.
Extremely large, 800 pounds.
Yes, I mean, 800 to 900 pounds.
They're amazing. And then also, there's other creatures of the sea, your lobster, your king crab. You have all of these creatures that can live incredibly long lives. And we have just been taking on the positioning that, you know, that nobody was paying attention to this. Nobody was listening to it except those that were associated with the industry. And they were doing the best that they could, but their voices were too small. They couldn't be heard too much.
There were people in academia and scientists that were going to see that, begin to see this picture and tried to point it out to governments fairly early in the game, but politics ruled the day, and it was more important to have jobs and growth than it was to look at maintenance of a long-term stability within the ocean's ecosystems.
Now, another factor that came in that made fishing more efficient, and something that I don't know if my listeners are aware of or not, fishing has always been a very dangerous business. And I know there's a series on television about fishing, and they sort of glamorize it, and it's anything but glamour.
The
Bering Sea, it is just so harsh. And I have talked with people that have been in that industry. I know what they go through, and I know how hard it is. I haven't experienced it firsthand, but it's through the interaction with them. But one of the things that also, one of many things that affected this, was the advancement of technology. And you talk about when World War II, and this came out of the Second World War, even though the war had devastated fishing fleets, I'm quoting right out of your book, of Western Europe and Japan, it left a legacy of new navigational devices, radar, Loran, advanced sound echoers, which are used by fishing fleets. There was a development of synthetic fibers like nylon. There was advanced propulsion and refrigeration technology, which really was important because you weren't going to have the rotting fish.
You were able to deliver them almost anywhere in the world once that got online.
Right, and that was a big step forward for the globalization, and
well,
quoting you exactly, an expansion.
The technology that came out in that century, in the 20th century, and particularly after World War II, completely revolutionized world fishing. So a boat that when I first started and I told the story of going out in 1948, the only thing we had on board other than a compass was an echo sounder and radio. Now you have devices that can precisely put you where you want to be. You can go anywhere in the world today, set your net at any depth, and actually monitor the amount of fish going into the net and the quantity that's in the net, and it's giving you this readout up in the wheelhouse.
And here in Alaska, they have been, I think, a good example. There's a lot of people that aren't happy with it, but they really are developing and refining how much can be taken out, and they're very thoughtful about many things because they're, for example, up in Sitka, they know that when the plankton starts to come in, there is like a line of species of fish. One feeds upon the other, and it's a nutritional chain that goes through this sea ecosystem. And they have become aware of how they have to monitor. And I'm not saying it's perfect, but at least they're aware and they're doing the best they can. And sometimes fishermen only have 2 hours.
Well, I think the consul that manages the fisheries in Alaska has probably done one of the best jobs in the world. Actually, they've had sustained yields now for almost 50 years, and they show no evidence that they significantly overfished any species.
And that should be an example. For
as an example,
other
nations. People should be looking at.
Yes, because there is a friend of mine that was talking about a lake in Michigan, and that whole, all of the fish in that lake were literally wiped out. And they had a big business with sports fishing. That was the big thing, but they had not regulated it. So when they closed the lake down, it was closed down for 3 years. And everything came back. It came back healthy. It was wonderful. And then they made a point of regulating it. And now they've got plenty of opportunity for fishing for just about anybody that goes out there. But they watch people like a hawk. Now, Dr. Alverson, we're going to take a break. Will you be able to stay with me for another 15 minutes?
Sure.
I'd love to have you. All right. We're going to take a break. We're talking about Race to the Sea. This is the autobiography of the marine biologist, Dr. Dayton Alverson, that I'm interviewing today. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about the world of the sea and what's going on today, and we'll be getting his professional opinion and personal opinion about what he thinks needs to be done. We're going to come back in just a moment. Donna Sebo here. Don't go away.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, TTAP.com.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right, Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272. To Tacoma, Washington 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today, 800-872-8852.
The Northwest Women's Show, presented by Northwest Hospital and Medical Center, is a show that's all about you. With 500 exhibits, free seminars, free samples, fashion shows, Gilles Marini from this season's Dancing with the Stars, and Dr. Lisa Masterson from the hit show The Doctors, plus shopping with great women's show specials, March 27th through 29th at Questfield Event Center. Show information at nwwomensshow.com. The Northwest Women's Show. It's such a girl thing.
Pete Smith here with OrthoTeb Health Shoes. These funky-looking shoes, invented by a medical doctor, will make you feel better. Who has time to work out these days? Wear our sandals or clogs around the house, go shopping, wear them on the treadmill. You'll burn extra calories. You'll tone and trim the legs, thighs, lower abdomen, rear end, your love handle area. You'll simply feel better. Check them out on the web at orthotebb.net.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. My guest today is Dr. Dayton L. Albertson, and his book is titled Race to the Sea, The Autobiography of a Marine Biologist. Now, if you think this would be dry reading, trust me, it's anything but dry. He talks about a lot of personal experiences and his travels around the world. If you're just tuning in, just know that this is a book that when you curl up to read it, you're going to find yourself going back in time, but also finding out why we are dealing with the conditions of feeding the world from the sea, or with the sea's gifts of protein, as you would say, all of its phenomenal species, is proving to be a real big channel. Dr. Albertson, while we were off the air, you were giving me some statistics about fishing and how seriously we have had an impact in a negative way on the oceans of the world. What are those statistics?
Well, I was telling you, if you look at the catch statistics for the 20th century from 1900, through from up to the present time, we took more fish in that century than probably all the fish that were caught in the previous centuries back to the time of Christ. And so in one century, we developed the technology, the capacity and capabilities of and products so that we could move them throughout the world. Boats could go anywhere in the world, any place, and be highly refined in their technologies, and so they could exploit almost any species at any place and return there and do it again with great efficiency, which allowed a significant amount of overfishing in certain areas of the world and impacts on the ocean ecosystems that weren't good for the long-term sustainability of the ecosystems or our world itself.
I was sharing your book with someone yesterday and some of the details that you had in your book, and this person said, well, there are areas of the ocean at this time that have literally been stripped naked of anything. The trawlers that went through picked up everything off of that section, those sections of ocean floor. Now, I don't know what part of the world's oceans that occurred in. They said they are talking about having to reseed them so that they can come back. The areas that have not been affected, that have not been touched, are eventually going to feel an impact. I remember seeing a program not too long ago about an area in Alaska where they have not had, there's not been any fishing really in a certain area of its waters, and everything is thriving. It's just doing beautifully.
Well, Alaska, fortunately, has set up a number of preserve areas where there are no fishing to be conducted. So they've got large marine preserves, probably as large as any place in the world, and so they've done a wonderful job to that extent.
Now, with other nations, we have had so much conflict through the years. Japanese trawlers, which are phenomenal, I mean, they're just massive. They were in Australian waters. They would be operating 24 hours a day. Their efficiency was so awesome and absolutely scary because anything and everything went into the hold of those huge ships and went to market. In today's world, we're dealing with a decimation of sharks, and they're finally realizing that just killing sharks to kill sharks is not a good thing. They are finally catching up with this. Do you see any relief with this? I mean, we're dealing with an international situation. There are people that are still stuck in the old days of, wow, we should be out there whaling, or we should be doing this, or should it's not the same. We've got over 6 billion people on this planet, and the population is still growing.
Well, I should make clear that I'm not opposed to harvesting the ocean's resources if they're harvested in a sustainable manner. But unfortunately, that hasn't been the case in many areas of the world. And you're quite right. If we continue down that path, we're going to be in difficulty. But I'm sort of optimistic that things have changed. And you see in a number of countries where I see sustainable programs developed, and there's a global group called the Marine Sustainable Fisheries Group that is helping people to go through a series of evaluations to ensure that they're fishing in a manner that's consistent with long-term productivity from the world's oceans. And I think this is sort of spreading around the world at the present time. Global catch is leveled off, and actually, you know, if I was to say, what are we going to be arguing about the rest of this century? It's just to what you were talking about earlier. How much aquaculture should we have? Because global aquaculture is now becoming a significant part of the total production. In terms of both fresh and salt water, I would say there's as much or more fish coming from aquaculture as there is actually coming from net fishing activity.
Which is good, because just as cultures in the past were able to keep the levels of, you know, fish in the sea healthy and where they could interact with them occasionally, but they didn't overfish it. And by developing their own aquaculture lagoons, and we're talking thousands of years ago, folks, this isn't something that's brand new on the planet. So it's a shift in thinking. There's a lot you bring out in your book, how many times media has blown things way out of proportion. They haven't had their facts together. Well, the people usually investigating it don't have a clue of what's going on anyway. So when you are dealing with misinformation like this, and let's say a member of my audience is told, oh, don't buy anything that's been grown in the aquaculture environment. It could be this, it could be that, or be that or the other. Where can they go to find out the right information? Because
well,
there's so much misinformation.
That's
out there.
A good question, because you even find the academicians arguing with each other, well, what's the appropriate a lot of them are opposed to aquaculture because they feel that there are certain toxins being released, that the fish are given certain antibiotics that are not good for our health in the long run. But those are issues that are going to have to be faced. But if you look at the industry, they are trying to face those. And I think, like any industries, as time goes by, they'll start to deal with those in a more rational manner.
I agree with you. Dr. Alverson, I know that we're just about out of time here, and I want to thank you so much for being my guest. I know that the book is available through Amazon, and you can also go to iUniverse.com. That's the letter I, the word universe.com. And also you can call the number 800-AUTHORS, 800-AUTHORS. And the book, again, is Race to the Sea, the Autobiography of a Marine Biologist. Dr. Dayton L. Alverson is my guest. And again, he's been affiliated with so many different aspects of the world of fishing And I love the way you present the fishermen and the rigors that they face. And your book is, in fact, dedicated to not just your beautiful wife, but also the fishermen of the world, of the world's oceans. And I think that that's very
fitting. I'm the scientist that try to provide the information where we can have sustainable yields.
That's right, sir. All three of them. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you, sir. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break for just a moment. Hey, when we come back, a little of this, a little of that. Again, Dr. Dayton L. Alverson, Race to the Sea. If you're interested in ecology, if you want to know more about the world's ocean, why not pick up a book about a man and his life? And he's living today, and he's going to be speaking at the University of Washington, right?
I hope so. You know.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Didn't tell you this, but I had a stroke in January, so I'm still on the recovery list, but I'm doing pretty good.
I would say so, and I'm looking forward. I hope I can attend that.
I hope you can, too.
I would love to do that. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedros. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
This is Pete Smith for OrthoTeb Health Shoes. OrthoTebs are completely heelless, invented by a doctor, and you'll burn 3 times the calories of regular walking in our sandals, 2 times the calories of regular walking in our clogs. They help you tone and trim the entire leg, thighs, buns, lower abs, and love handle area. They offer symptom improvement for people with plantar fasciitis and low back pain. Check them out on the web at www.orthoteb.net.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna, and I know we've got a caller on the line waiting, and I want to say, please, caller, don't hang up. I'll be with you in just a moment. Quick like a bunny, I want to remind you, for those of you in the Pacific Northwest, I am going to be appearing at the Northwest Women's Show. This is exciting. The Donna Sebo Show is going to be center stage in an area that's going to have a big banner saying Girl Talk. I'm going to have five special guests. We're going to have a guest at the top of every hour starting at 11 a.m., on March 27th, which is the first day of the show. So we're going to be talking money, we're going to be talking fitness, we're going to be talking education, we're going to be talking about all kinds of things, and you and being a part of the audience, just come on over to the stage, you can see, check the program, you'll know about it. And I'm going to have a booth number 406, and we are going to be there, I will be there, available for many readings during the entire weekend. Hey, get in touch with your girlfriends. Say, hey, let's give a gift to ourselves and go out and boogie and have fun. Yes. The Northwest Women's Show, March 27th, 28th, and 29th. I've been participating in this for the last few years. I just love it. It's just exciting. So come on down to Seattle, to the Quest Convention Center, and know you're going to have a good time. Get tickets for the whole weekend. It's just great. Also, I've got a class coming up April 25th, Saturday. It'll be starting at 10 in the morning, finishing at 4. This is called Mind Vision. It's going to be about powering yourself up so that you can be what you want to be and achieve what you want to achieve. And we're also going to be focusing quite a bit on developing intuitive skills. So give me a call if you're interested at 800-872-8852. Starting next week, I'll be giving you information on the number you can call to make reservations, and if you mention the show, you get a $10 discount. Let's go to our caller who's been waiting very patiently. Thank you so much. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Yes, my first initial is C, and I'm calling from the Southern Athens, Georgia area.
Southern Athens, Georgia. I was there once, and oh, what gorgeous country you have there.
Oh, thank you.
Now, hon, let's get busy because I know our time will fly away like the wind if we're not careful. Now, the first thing that's coming into my mind is that you must continue your education. Now, you have been at a bit of crossroads because you're not finding that the income generation that you want to have is going to evolve very quickly, and there may be a relocation coming in due to a job opportunity. I don't know that you'd be very far away from Athens, but I do think that you are going to have to make a choice because this opportunity is going to be so good that you're going to say, as much as I hate to leave the area and as beautiful as it is, this is going to take a priority. Now, your world, especially starting towards the latter part of this year and going into 2010, is absolutely going to be exploding. You're not going to have a whole bunch of time to fiddle around. It seems like focus on career, focus on personal disciplines, be attentive to how you manage your time, how you manage your schedule. This is going to be very, very important. So working with yourself right now physically has been a goal of yours. It's like you really want to get yourself fit and in shape and that type of thing, and that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. But you also must start incorporating in the discipline of consistency and sort of dealing with what I'd call schedules. And you usually like to wing it by the seat of your pants. You've been pretty good. But you're evolving into a level of skill and expertise where being prepared is going to be more favorable for you than just trying to wing it. Okay? So you need to understand that you're entering into a whole different level of thinking. So I want you to continue your education. I want you to start adding to your personal library. I want you to look at doing maybe an hour less of television a day or whatever you have. Put yourself in the environments mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually that represent the highest and the best to you. Oh. And hold true. You're on your way, hon. You're doing good. But the work is going to be intensifying. It's not going to be coming less. It's going to become more. But that's the only way you're going to find yourself being able to reach the objectives you desire.
Great. Oh, I'm glad.
Do you have a question for me?
Yes. And, you know, you basically have answered some. I am getting my PhD in the next couple months, and I do have the schedule thing that is just driving me nuts because I have a 2-year-old. I do not have a personal life right now because – it's so intense with working, and it did start picking up more in the last couple months. But I wondered, do you see, am I going to get to have a personal life? Because I noticed you were speaking about the career, but it's taken over my entire life, basically.
Well, hon, don't worry about the personal. I'll tell you why. You still are sort of stuck into certain concepts regarding personal relationships that, as far as I'm concerned, they relate to, like, the teenage years.
Uh-huh.
And you, and I'm not saying this to be harsh, you need to realize that as you have grown and evolved and you are coming into this professional positioning, you are going to need a partner that is really going to be a partner. You're going to need someone who understands your desire to really make a difference and your work ethic, and they're going to have the same kind of feel for it. You don't want somebody that is going to be some ding-dong from the local Hasha house, what somebody might call a boy toy. No, you don't need that.
Right.
You need somebody that's going to be a part of your life that you can communicate with, that you can really enjoy that partnership with, and you can grow with.
And I'll get that, right? I just have to be patient.
That's right. You just have not evolved into those communities of people. And if somebody listening says, oh, boy, that sounds hoity-toity, not really. You know, there's a difference. We've got all kinds of garbage that's dumped on us that says, oh, this is the Hollywood image or whatever image of what things are supposed to be. No. You need to really be in truth with yourself about the quality of character that you want to have in a companion. I'm looking at you eventually being married and being very happy. But you have right now a child that's 2 years old. This baby needs your time. It's going to take a lot of energy. And the likelihood at this point, because of your commitment and your dedication to your education and to improving your life, if you abandon that right now, you'll have no one to blame but yourself.
Right.
So don't get in a pity pot about a personal situation, because you want to attract the type of man who is going to take joy in having your child as a part of his life, and is going to be not just proud of you, but going to be very supportive of you and what you do. And you want someone that you can sit and talk to, for heaven's sakes, that's not going to be sitting and fussing if the pancakes aren't flipped the right way.
That's true. Are
you getting the picture?
Yes, I do.
All right.
For turning the light on.
I want you to understand that there are many, many women that you will come in contact with that are going to come out with all kinds of verbal jive, saying, oh, you need this something hot, and they need this, blah, 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 blah. I want you to realize something. Most of these women making these comments are not continuing their education. And joking is fine, but day-to-day reality is something else. And I'm seeing you eventually merging with people that are going to be so sincerely dedicated, men and women both, into dedicating themselves towards making life a quality. And you're going to be teaching off and on. I mean, my goodness, it's just going to be such a significant part of your life. What's your PhD in?
It's going to be in metaphysics, and I did already, and it's so funny because what I do now, I work with people, and my coworker told me about you because we both are counselors. And she was telling me to call, and you're right on. Yeah, I'm getting my PhD in metaphysics.
All right, that's fine, dear, but you need some practical application.
Right. I have 3 degrees in psychology and with behavior therapy, but I kind of wanted to stick with being able to add to the counseling, and the psychology wasn't enough.
All right, let me give you some tips that I think could help you. And, that's just what I do. So if you are interested, start researching neuro-linguistic programming to add to your pile.
Neural distance?
NLP,
oh.
Neuro-Linguistic Programming.
Oh, okay.
All right. And a man who was my guest is very knowledgeable about it. Look up Richard Bandler, Bandler. And I've got a number of other resources. But you need to understand something. A lot of what you will have learned in school is going to be flushed down the toilet.
Okay.
Real life and real application is very important. And a lot of the things that you have gone through in school, and that's not saying school was a waste. It's not. not by any stretch of the imagination. But if you really want to make the difference, then you need to understand that you have to step out of paradigms. So if I'm sounding a little forceful, I want you to know that there's a reason for it. I want you to be able to achieve what you really want to achieve and be able to add quality, not fluff stuff, but quality.
Oh, thank you.
So align yourself with those individuals that you would respect and appreciate, and make time, spend time with those people so that they can be an example for you, and you can make your own trail.
Thank you.
You're welcome, dear. You have a wonderful day. I'm almost out of time here, so I'm going to have to say goodbye. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, it has been a wonderful hour. I'm so grateful to Dr. Alverson for being able to spend some extra time with me. You know, we stand on the shoulders of the people that go before us, and it's so important. It's so very important for us to realize you never are too old to learn. You are never too old to give something to life, to be the best that you want to be. And Dr. Alverson, at 81 years of age, and yeah, I'd never have known it, this is a man that's still giving. This is a man that is still learning. He doesn't turn himself off from life. So wherever you are, if you're in a pity pot, get out of it. You got a great weekend ahead of you. We're going to be back here, right here at bbsradio.com, same time, same place. And we're going to be talking about, on Monday, how complaint is a gift. This is Donna Sebo. God bless. Have a fabulous weekend. I'll be back in the Puget Sound, Northwest area, on Monday. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo. You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.